The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead. Mindful that many of you may be in a holiday mood, we're abandoning our usual seriousness to indulge you with a daily series of comic tales from some of our favourite writers. They range across fiction, non-fiction and memoir and are all part of a funny stories special in the Guardian's Weekend magazine. You can read the text versions at theguardian.com. This is one of six podcasts we'll have for you. Enjoy.
I'm Tessa Hadley, and I'm reading my story, Her Share of Sorrow. Ruby's mother, Dahlia, used to be a dancer before she had her children. Then she trained to be a psychotherapist, and you got the feeling she'd disowned her dancing days, looking back on them as delusion and vanity. Yet still she carried herself in that dancer's exquisitely conscious way, as if she was held taut by a thread running up from the crown of her head. She was still hollowly thin and painted her eyes with black upward-swept lines and wore her hair pulled back austerely from the sculpted bones of her face. Serious psychotherapist glasses added intellectual distinction to Dahlia's other graces. Ruby's name might have suited her if she'd been smouldering and mysterious like her mother in the dance photographs. But she was plump and stubby with short, fat arms, lank, beige-colour hair and fair, freckled skin that turned pink easily in the sun or if she told lies, which she quite often did. She looked like a changeling in that family, other people thought, because Ruby's older brother Nico and her father Adrian, administrator for an innovative theatre company, were also distinguished and beautiful and tall, like Dahlia, and very thin. Scrupulously, because they'd read all the right guides to parenting, Adrian and Dahlia ignored Ruby's greedy eating at the supper table. They never had cake or ice cream in the house, but she raided the cupboards and stole money to buy sweets. There was always a mess of crumbs and wrappers on the floor around where she sat playing on her computer. Each evening, Dahlia arrived in her daughter's bedroom, strained and full of reasoned explanation, to enforce their rule that Ruby was only supposed to have computer time for an hour. This resulted in stormy sessions of weeping on both their parts. Lying on her back on her Spider-Man duvet, Ruby wailed at the ceiling, her small mouth stretched open in an ugly shape, her face hot pink. "What am I supposed to do?" she lamented. "There's nothing for me to do in this house." "But she isn't interested in anything," Dahlia, also lamenting, wailed to her husband. "She doesn't draw, she doesn't read, she doesn't play imaginative games, she's not even sporty, she can't swim. And she isn't finding out information on the wretched computer. She's just looking at pictures of kittens in Wellington boots or playing Crossy Road or messaging her friends. Not that she's got any friends." "That's not fair," Adrian reproached his wife gently. "She does have friends." "Yes, but such hopeless ones." Dahlia remembered taking Nico to an exhibition of Greek art when he was much younger than Ruby was now. She had loved watching him as he dwelled on each momentous sculpture, huge eyes drinking it in. Then he'd read the accompanying information absorbedly, running his finger along under the words on the plaques. Now Nico had a place to do PPE at Oxford and was a gifted cellist. Needless to say, Ruby's fingers wouldn't even work to cover the holes on the recorder. Her parents had gone to great lengths to get her into a good school where she might be stimulated. She had a lovely teacher, a real high flyer who kept a separate spreadsheet on her phone for each of the children in her class, making a note whenever they learned anything new. At parents' evenings, this teacher was brightly hopeful about Ruby, who sat stolidly somewhere in the middle of her attainment targets. Ruby was 10 years old when they borrowed a house in the south of France from friends for 3 weeks in the summer. Adrian and Nico hired bikes and were out all day. Dahlia needed desperately to unwind and leave her clients behind. She took her book out into the garden where an apricot tree was trained against a crumbling brick wall and flower beds were edged with lavender, bracing herself for conflict with Ruby, who couldn't live without Wi-Fi and hated the sun. She came out, scowling into the brightness, stomping her feet in her jelly shoes. Hopefully, Dahlia suggested she should go exploring. "This is a fascinating old place," she said. "It belonged to the Williams parents. They've been coming here forever. There are all kinds of treasures in the outhouses." "But I don't care about the Williams," Ruby said. Dahlia closed her eyes, and after a pause, the jelly shoes stomped indoors again. Then things went rather quiet inside the house. Dahlia fell asleep in the healing warmth under the shade of the faded striped umbrella, and when she woke up an hour later and everything was still quiet, she felt afraid. Stepping indoors where the shutters were barred against the blazing day, she was blind at first in the shadows. Ruby wasn't anywhere to be found downstairs or on the first floor. Dahlia climbed the steep, uncarpeted steps to the attic which the Williams only used to store old junk. The heat up here under the roof was feral, dizzy-making. Some furtive noise from behind the closed attic door, a small scratching or rustling, made her hesitate outside it. "Ruby, are you in there? Are you all right?" "I'm fine, thank you." There was something peculiar about Ruby's voice, prim and slippery and secretive. For all her professional openness to things sexual, Dahlia shied away from opening the door, afraid of what might be on the other side. "All right, darling, just so long as you're okay." Ruby spent all day in the attic, with only a break for baguette, and appeared downstairs chastely enough, though hot-faced, at supper time. She ate without commenting on the food, and as soon as the meal was finished, slipped upstairs again. "I'm just doing something," she said, avoiding eye contact. The three left behind in peace, to play chess or read or make music — there was a passable piano for Adrian and Nico had brought his cello — looked at one another in amused perplexity. "You know what she's doing, don't you?" Adrian said later, coming down from visiting the bathroom. "Do I want to know?" "She's just reading." "Reading? Really?" "I opened the door a crack and peeked inside, and she didn't even hear me, just sitting there, sucking her hair, completely lost inside her book, though it's still boiling up there under the roof." "What book?" "She didn't bring any books." At 10 o'clock, they had to call Ruby down to go to bed. When she was asleep, they tried the attic door, but found that she had locked it and hidden the key. The next day, after breakfast, she slipped inconspicuously upstairs again. Nico followed her up to the attic. Though finely sensitive, he was not above teasing his exasperating sister, and found this time she'd locked the door on the inside. Dahlia did feel vaguely guilty. Who knew what books Ruby had stumbled upon? They might be pornography or sinister old medical textbooks. The Williams were rather awful. But the peace in the quiet house was blissful, and she was soon addicted to her hours alone in the walled garden. Behind the locked door, Ruby was already 3/4 of the way through East Lynne. This was only one volume in a promisingly tall pile of Treasury classics. The Woman in White, The Cloister and the Hearth, Ivanhoe, Lady Audley's Secret. Uniformly bound in red with gold lettering. The younger generation of Williamses had moved them up here to make room on their shelves for something slightly less dated. They bought the book a shortlist every year, and the backlist was overspilling their London home. When Ruby first strayed into the attic, she had opened the volume on the top of the pile in a spirit of despairing mockery because she'd never in the least liked books before. The ones she'd been given as presents or been forced to read in class had seemed too drearily like her own real-life childish routines of home and school and family. She hadn't had any idea that books could transport you like this into something better. At night, falling asleep, she snuffed up the fragrance of damp, spotted old pages on her fingers. In the mornings, she hurried through her chocolate milk and croissant, hungry to get back to her story. Much of East Lynne, in truth, was fairly incomprehensible. She stumbled among strange facts in a thick fog. The prohibitions that weighed so heavily on Lady Isabel Vane and Sir Francis Levison, what had they done wrong exactly, were all the more compelling for their obscurity. Some grandeur in the language intoxicated her. She was astonished when little William died. Children always got better in books, didn't they? "I have seen the flowers we shall see in heaven," he said, 10 times brighter than our flowers here. When God takes a little child there, it is because he loves him." The audacity of it took Ruby's breath away, as if something raw and wild had been dragged from where it was concealed into the daylight. Tears flooded into her eyes. What was inside her seemed poured out onto the page. "I have had more than my share of sorrow," Madame Vine said. "Sometimes I think that I cannot support it." When day faded in the attic, Ruby went on reading by torchlight, and when at last she had to go to bed, she placed her silken bookmark with trembling fingers. She staggered up dazedly from the world of her story, as if the one she returned to were the insubstantial fiction. By the end of their holiday, she had read East Lynne and The Heir of Redcliffe and was a good way into Lady Audley's secret. Now she would never find out what the secret was. Although it was searing to be torn away from her book, Ruby had never dreamed of carrying it off with her. It would have been a desecration to steal one volume from where it belonged among its fellows. Anyway, she liked to think of it left behind in the attic, empty without her, somnolent in the sunshine, lizards basking on the stone windowsill outside, motionless as stone itself. At home in Crouch End, it didn't occur to her, she wasn't resourceful, that she could have got hold of Lady Audley easily enough, in a library or online. She couldn't ask her parents or her brother for help, because she was afraid of letting them in on her reading discoveries in case they somehow appropriated them, turning out to know already all about the Williams's wonderful books. Ruby clung on to an indistinct idea, in fact, that the copy of Lady Audley she'd read was the only copy, the single exemplar, unique in the world. Fatalistically, she accepted its loss, and her days were bitter with the flavour of exile from her whole self. There were 2 weeks of holiday left before she returned to school. She went on playdates with friends, was taken to see Pudsey the dog, and went back to quarrelling with Dahlia. But all this listlessly, as if her heart wasn't in it. Then during one dull rainy afternoon, while her mother had sessions with clients and Nico was supposed to be looking after her but was browsing his laptop on the sofa, Ruby was filled from one moment to the next with a vision of possibility. All its elements, the possession of the right virgin notebook, a picture of her own head bowed in rapt concentration over her page, the shape of her story, came together in a single lightning strike of inspiration. "Where are you off to, Pud?" Nico said without looking up. "No going anywhere near Mama, you know that." "Just had a thought," said Ruby, innocently. "A thought? You're kidding me." Her parents were delighted with whatever was keeping Ruby quiet in her bedroom. They supposed she had resumed the reading she'd begun in France. In fact, she'd only glanced briefly inside the old, unloved books on her shelf at home, whose ordinary reality was flavourless as ever. but she'd found something to do that matched or even outdid the thrill of her French books. And one evening her joy in her day's creation overflowed her caution. She announced to her family that she was writing a novel. "Darling, that's wonderful," said Dahlia with real warmth. "How interesting." Adrian, beaming, said that he'd always thought she might have a novelist in her. "You could show it to your new class teacher," Dahlia said. "What's it about?" Already Ruby was regretting telling them. "Things," she said insouciantly. They couldn't have been more enthusiastic. Adrian promised that when she was finished, he'd show it to a friend who was a publisher. Yet oddly, even in their enthusiasm, there was something tainting and disappointing, perhaps because no amount of it could ever match the power and importance Ruby felt when she was making things up. Sucking her hair, Biro squeezed in her clutching fat fingers, joining up her letters laboriously. She transcribed the scenes unfolding in her mind's eye. Her whole body, kneeling up on her chair, hunched over her notebook, seemed shaken by their intensity. Sometimes she spoke the words she wrote aloud or acted them out with a scowl or disdainful toss of her head. Her family professed great interest in reading her novel, but she held back with uncharacteristic restraint. Something delicate in her story needed her protection. Carefully, whenever she finished writing, she stowed her notebook away under the mattress on her bed. But one late afternoon, in a careless moment between chapters, she left it lying on her desk while she foraged in the stash of biscuits in her wardrobe. Nico, peering in from the room next door where he was marking time uneasily before Balliol, swooped on it. Ruby ran screaming downstairs after him to where their parents were making salad in the kitchen. "Dad, he's got my novel! He's stolen it!" "Nico, that's not on." No, really, it's brilliant," Nico said, laughing, holding it out of Ruby's way where she was jumping up at him, trying to snatch at it. "It's unforgivable, Nico," Dahlia said, pausing sternly with an organic tomato in one hand and a knife in the other. "Give it back to her right now." "Listen, let me read you some of this. You won't believe it." Lady Carol, her cheek pale as a dove's wing, swept from the ballroom with a flash of her exquisite eyes, dragging her long amber curls behind her. "Do you think she's taken off her wig?" "Meanwhile, Frederick Fillet gazed into the dying coals, coals spelt C-O-L-E-S, of the fire." "I like the sound of Frederick Fillet," Adrian said. "Is he our hero?" Ruby knew this was all a disaster, and yet, succumbing to a writer's vanity, she couldn't help half wanting to hear her words take on their own life in the world. Her eyes were fixed on Nico, pleading, but also with a greedy curiosity. What did she sound like, really? Wouldn't they be amazed? Wouldn't the words forged in such passion stupefy her audience, making them at last see what she saw? She mouthed over silently what Nico was reading out loud. "But," stuttered Lady Carol, dread seeping into her, "surely you are not the one who once betrayed me and ran off with another woman." The cords of her life were snapping. "It cannot be," Frederick sobbed, laying his rugged head upon her breasts. "Forgive me, you are much more beautiful than she is." "Upon her breasts," Adrian said. "My word." "I do not reproach you," Lady Carol said, "because really she is quite nice." Ruby spun round on her parents, riven suddenly with suspicion. Adrian was grinning helplessly. The back of Dahlia's hand, still clutching the vegetable knife, was pressed against her mouth, and her eyes behind her glasses seemed to be staring in distress. For a moment, Ruby believed her mother was ravaged by the emotion in the story. Then she saw that her shoulders were shaking. "What are you all laughing at?" she shouted. furiously. Why is it funny? She stayed barricaded and inconsolable in her room that evening, though they all came humbly with apologies and left propitiatory presents, even chocolate. I'm very, very angry with Nico, Dahlia communicated through the closed door. It was very wrong of him. We didn't really think your story was funny, darling. We were just laughing with... Ruby heard her search for the right word. With delight, that's all. Ruby had her notebook back and was writing in it again. At first she worked bitterly and without conviction. They had hollowed out the best thing she'd ever done. She would finish the stupid story any old how, just to prove they were right and what an idiot she was. As time passed, however, the work regained its hold over her, and the plot altered unexpectedly from her original idea. Outside her bedroom window it grew dark, and the ordinary landscape of smart back gardens and pergolas and trampolines receded. An extraordinary huge moon, the colour of yellow cream, rose into the turquoise sky and seemed to be dissolving into an aureole of light around its rim. A mysterious wasting fever struck down all the members of Lady Carroll's family and also Frederick Fillet, one by one. Lady Carroll never slept, but moved between their bedsides, holding up a lamp, putting precious drops of water to their lips and wiping their brows with paper tissues. All in vain. "Oh, but it is hard to part," they murmured. By the time Ruby had finished, on the last line of the last page in her notebook as she'd always planned, they had all passed beyond that river from whose bourne there is no known return, and Lady Carroll was left alone. Ruby dropped tears on her page for her dear family. Her heart was swollen with love and rightly triumph.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.